For most of the last 30 years, I have raku fired. That's been my primary source of colouring and finishing.
Hi, I'm Bob Acton, and I'm host of the Color and Ceramics Podcast. Welcome to today's show. I'm super excited about having Susan Halls on the show today. After graduating from the Royal College of Art, she established her first studio in Putney, London. Exhibition invitations came from galleries across the UK, with opportunities to show work in Europe and Japan. In 1998, she married and moved to the USA, eventually settling to live in New England, working from her home studio in Massachusetts. 2017 saw her return to the UK. She now lives in Cornwall and says, "I am making the best work of my life." And I would agree because she makes fantastic figurative art. And I'm sure you'll enjoy the show. Welcome and let's get to it.
Welcome to Color and Ceramics, the podcast for ceramic artists who want valuable ideas about using color from leading artists and world-class experts. Here's your host, Bob Acton, a sculptor and ceramic artist who's fascinated with color and how potters, sculptors, and artists use color in their work. Tune in as he talks with his guests about color, techniques, and the impact of color on people and art itself.
Susan, thank you so much for joining the Color and Ceramics podcast. We're excited about having you here today. We love your work, and I think I got oriented to your work when I saw your cats, and that was a little while ago. But hey, so thanks very much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Bob.
Yeah, you're most welcome. I wonder if you could tell our audience, because this is an audio only podcast, people aren't going to get to see your work on the podcast. If you could tell people a little bit about your work, what is it that you do?
Okay, well, gosh, that's a huge question. I'll try and be brief. I think when people ask me, you know, what do you do, I will sort of boil it down. So I might say I'm an artist or a ceramic artist. Sometimes I say I'm a potter. Very often I say I'm a sculptor, but I work with clay. I use pottery techniques and I make mostly animal sculpture, images of animals, which are not highly representational, but are very much a personal response to the subject. And I've always worked that way. When I've made my animals, I mean, a few exceptions, probably commissions, but left to my own devices, I'm looking for a way to interpret the animal form or reinterpret the animal form in a very personal way. And it changes all the time. You know, what I was interested in 6 months ago or a year ago will be different to how I'm feeling. Or the work I'm wanting to produce at this time. So I have a very small stable of subjects, which are on a sort of carousel, and I revisit them over periods of time. They don't get off. I get on, and have a very obsessive appetite for a particular kind of animal, and some get more working than others. So for instance, pigs, dogs, sheep, rabbits are very go back right to my student days. But cats, which lots of people will see on my Instagram, are really new. I've not tackled the cat subject before, other than a couple of odd pieces. So they're new to the carousel, but they're not getting off.
So tell me, what is it that brings these animals together? So there's pigs and dogs and cats, as you've said, and sheep and so on. From your perspective, what is it that links those together? Why do those fit on the carousel together?
I think there's two reasons. One is these are domesticated animals, so I see them all the time, or I can go and find them fairly easily. Whereas something like an elephant, I've really got to make an effort to go
Yes, no kidding. Yeah.
and find an elephant, or a giraffe or something like that. I think it's because I particularly where I'm living now, which is fairly rural, and I just these animals, I see them a lot. I'm exposed to them quite a lot. And the other element is that, and I know this is a fact, is that within each subject, there's a very broad way to interpret it. It's not a fixed thing. So dog, if you say dog to someone, everyone's going to have a slightly different image that pops up in their mind. But there is no specific thing about a dog, really. I mean, obviously, four legs, maybe a tail, but it's a very much an image that is fluid and in flux and allows me to go in and almost do a little bit of sort of genetic engineering. And I like that about certain subjects. So dog has it, and bird has it. I feel all the subjects I choose have it to more or less a degree. But do you see what I'm saying? Is it's an elephant is much more specific in its appearance.
There's generally one type of elephant, or I know there's a couple. I know in reality there's a couple, but they really look very similar. Whereas dogs, and I'm a lover of dogs, have many, many looks to them.
And I think a lot of this is to do not so much with birds, although you could apply it to chickens, but there's like man's interference in the genetic crossbreed.
Yes,
So you get
absolutely.
that with sheep, you get it with cats, you certainly get it with fowl, domesticated birds. Dogs is just like the top of the heap. For constant reinvention. So there's a very strong element of that in the subjects that I am interested in. But having said that, Bob, I'm actually getting incredibly interested in lions,
Really?
which I have never sculpted, drawn, but never sculpted. But I keep seeing it in images of like medieval art and armory and sort of regal heraldic imagery. It keeps popping up and it just keeps just like tempting me. But it's going to be a tough one.
Yeah, this might be a whole new carousel. You might have now two carousels working, right?
The only odd one out on my carousel, it's only odd because it is an exotic animal, are the monkeys. And they haven't really visited for a while, but they are deep in my history as a maker. But they are an exotic animal. And again, they're an animal that is very loose in interpretation.
So
So I.
let's talk about your interpretation, because I think that's really interesting. So you've got these characters, dogs and so on, that we all know, right? And you apply your interpretation. So tell us about this interpretation for you, this kind of visceral thing, I think,
Well,
for
that's a
you.
nice way to put it. Yeah, it is very visceral. Oh, Bob, it's so hard to like find a beginning. But one instance would be drawing, which is fundamental to how I work. So I will begin by sketching. That can often mean sketching from the live animal. And when I'm doing that, even though it might be a subject I've drawn many, many times, each revisit, I notice something a little bit different. And it's really about shapes. It's about the form of the animal. I'll notice something that I haven't paid attention to before, or I'm just more interested in that aspect of an animal. So as I'm sketching, I can already see a way of making what it is that I'm interested in about that animal. So something will start to sort of simmer to the surface. It might just be like the really skinny little legs and the way the feet are shaped, you know, and this big body mass on top. Or it might be just something to do with the sort of volume of the rib cage and the shoulders that's just suddenly really become much more evident to me. Or some nuance of the head. There'll be something there that I'm already engaging with and thinking, oh yeah. And then I'm starting to make it in my mind. I think, oh, I could do it this way or that way. And because I embrace so many different techniques, I'm sort of shuffling through in my mind the best technique to allow me to interpret this new image that I'm coming up with. So all this is sort of scampering around in my mind, hopefully. And it's really exciting. I think at its best is when I'm drawing and I'm already feeling my way into the making. But I wouldn't skip the sketching stage because that really is my sort of hunter-gatherer process. And that information is so important to me back in the studio so I can refer to it. But I think when I'm drawing in a way that is also thinking about the making.
That's really interesting. That's interesting that you've got a, you sort of think as of your pencil or your pen or whatever it is you sketch with, as kind of like your hunting instrument, right? Some people hunt with a gun, of course. Some people hunt with a camera in order to get some pictures, and you hunt with a pencil. And
Oh, it's lovely. Yes,
that's
it's
very,
just
yeah, that's
lovely.
very
Yeah.
interesting. Yeah,
It's a
absolutely.
much more humane way of bringing the animal
Yeah,
home.
absolutely. And when I look at your work, I see, in my impression anyway, a big focus on form. And like that seems to be very important in your work. Did I get that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And so understanding just basic animal anatomy has been very important for me. It's not something I always knew about. I had a good visual memory for animal form, but I didn't necessarily know the engineering that was involved. So about 20 years ago, I started to put much more time into studying this and drawing, improving my drawing, so that I could understand this information, get it into my drawings. Because in doing that, it means that when I'm drawing from life, I can draw the animal from any angle. So perspective, I'm not afraid of, which I used to be because I didn't understand it. So I have a much sort of stronger ability now to draw what it is I'm looking at and understand it. And in doing so, I can draw more volumetrically, and because I also understand enough about animal anatomy, all of that is hopefully sitting in those studies as well. It's been a long, slow process, but I think, you know, I've always been interested in animal form, but I was never able to draw it very well until I acquired more skill over a period of time. So yeah, it's just, oh, animal form, it's just the just I've always just been so excited about it. You know, even as a child, I didn't know that that's what I was responding to, but I remember the first time I was able to have a dog, and I was in my mid-20s when I'd never had a dog before, and I was madly making dogs at this time. And I got this dog from the shelter, very young. Not a puppy, but a young dog. I brought it home and I gave it some food. And I remember just looking at its feet, thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to get to see these feet every day and draw them and feel them and understand them. And it was so exciting that I had four dog's feet that I was now very privy to having this animal in my life every day. And just being so excited about dog's feet, because I've never had dog's feet in my life before. You know, I would see them and draw them, but to actually own them, as it were.
Yeah, that's very cool. They can sit beside you and you can fiddle or fondle with the feet and really get a sense of it, and then transfer that tactile muscle sensation to your work that you're doing, isn't it?
Yeah, to really just be able to look and study at close quarters like that and really understand, in a tactile way.
How did you learn the muscular structure, the anatomy of animals? What was your method what was your most successful method that you had?
Well, I went back to school, basically. So I was living in the States. I was in Connecticut, and I just decided I want to be a student again. And I knew the weaknesses in my drawing ability. I was always good at drawing, but I knew I had some huge voids that I wanted to tackle. And that was basically understanding perspective, which sounds like a small thing, but it's massive. Because it's basically being able to understand the three-dimensional world and put that down on paper and dissect it and explode it and put it back together again. So I found a class at an art school called the Silvermine Guild Art Center, or the Silvermine School of Art, and I took a couple of classes there with a brilliant teacher called Jack Kovach. I have to acknowledge him. He was so astoundingly good. And I'm talking about, this is not an art school for a degree or anything. It's what we'd call in the UK evening class or adult education.
Oh, yeah.
So a few hours every week I'd go, and I took a very dry drawing class to understand perspective, and I went back to do figure drawing as well, which I hadn't really done since art school. And I worked at this for about 3 years, and because I had such a great teacher, and because I wanted to learn, I just dedicated myself to it. And I would not only do all the work in class, but I would go away and I'd do extra work, and I'd bring it in, and Jack would look at it and criticize it, absolutely as if I were a student taking an MA or a BA. Absolutely first-class teaching. But because I was studying perspective and figure drawing at the same time, I used to challenge myself and go to the museums to draw animal skeletons, which I never would have done before, because that's just, it's like trying to draw the inside of a cathedral or something. But I just kept going and looking at animal skeletons and trying to draw them, or skulls. I had some skulls of my own. I would draw those in my studio. And actually realizing, it was like a light going on, that animal skeletons, mammals, were all the same. We're all really got the same bones. There's just some adaptations. And that was astounding. And the same with the musculature. Once you understand how the human body is formed, is made up, other animals are really not any different. You know, big bones mean big muscles. Thin bones, thin long bones are going to mean thin long muscles, and it all just sort of gelled together. It was slow, it was painful, but it was a determined path that I was on, and it really was down to Jack being so generous and helpful.
It is really important to find a teacher who has those characteristics that you talked about that you really can connect to. But I guess in addition to that, I hear that you were tenacious in your learning. You decided you were going to practice and work hard and going to museums and looking at different things and getting feedback. That was really the key component for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Because well, I've always wanted to be the best student in the class. Even when I was at art school. And actually, I'll just raise a point here because lots of people say, well, you did 6 years of art school and nobody ever taught you how to draw. Well, no, because I was always in ceramics. I was in studio ceramics. We had some what they called visual studies and drawing classes, but no one really taught you the nuts and bolts of how to draw. That was for, fine art students. So I had to go and find it myself. But wanting to be the best student in the class, and particularly because I adored Jack and I wanted to please him, I wanted to be the best student. He would say things in class about when because he was in his 70s, retired professor at this point. But he used to talk about what he'd done, the projects he'd given his students at the university in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And he'd talk about some of the projects. And I think, oh, I'm going to go away and do that. So I things that he just brought up lightly in class, I thought, right, I'll go and do that as my homework. And I bring them in, and I think he loved that and responded to that, and just he could see how hungry I was. He knew I was a professional artist, and he just took me under his wing and just gave me as much as he could. It was not easy. I have to say, it was not easy, and it wasn't natural for me. To acquire these skills. Really, understanding perspective is dry. It's a horrible, dry, agonizing, torturous process for someone like me. And it was very, very hard work, but it was only through doing and doing and doing extra that the penny, it was literally like a penny dropping very slowly.
Now,
Very exciting.
who has inspired you on the clay side? So you talk about Jack with the drawing side and the perspective side, of course, but what about on the clay side? Who has
Well, Picasso is
inspired you?
my hero. Picasso is my god. And I absolutely love his ceramics, all of it. In terms of ceramics, just as a pure subject, Ruth Duckworth, I absolutely love. I tend to I'm drawn to people who work very abstractedly or are vessel makers. So Michael Cardew, I absolutely adore his work, but Ruth Duckworth is a big one for me. There's so many. I'm not going to be able to name them all. Gillian Lowndes, who's another British maker who's not with us anymore, unfortunately. She does some extraordinary work, really pushing the envelope. I love a lot of what Alison Britton has done, particularly her most recent work. I really like abstract form in ceramic. Because when I look at figurative, I'm going to sound really pompous now, but when I look at figurative work, I tend to be very critical. I'm because it's my field, I go into it with a critical eye and I think, oh, you really made that body too short, Oh, and it obviously wasn't intentional. And I go in as a teacher and I just start doing a sort of tutorial. With the pieces.
But your work is figurative yet abstract, right? So, what are you trying to achieve with that, or how are you approaching that abstract nature of
Oh
the
gosh,
animal?
do you see it as abstract?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Oh gosh, that's fantastic. But I wish I could see it that way. I feel like I'm so far from where I want to be. I really wish I could find a way to create abstracted animal imagery that is not abstract in the normal sense of being angular and almost cubist. I'm and it's you could I'm you know paring things down to, I hate the word essences, but let's use it. For me isn't abstraction. I really feel that there's another level that I want to try and clamber up to, which somehow loses the animal form a little more without it just being a stylized image. And
Well,
that's.
your folded pieces, right? Those little pieces
Yeah,
that you
yeah.
fold over. I'm looking right now at a statue you've made of multiples of these folded ones that
Oh,
rise up, right?
yes.
That
That.
really has the essence of some form, but I don't think that it would evoke that kind of criticism in people, because I know what you mean. You know, if the form isn't right, then people see it's not right. They might not be able to articulate why it's not right, and that catches their mind then. But with your pieces here that have the essence of the animal, yet it's not designed in that figurative way, I mean, it really does capture that.
Actually, I yeah, those pieces are slightly outside of my sort of core studio work. It's something quite different that I'm trying to do, using those very simplified animal forms, almost as like building units. And I do want to go on and develop those into being almost more architectural. Yeah, the animals don't really have a personality to them because I've taken away the eyes and the ears, so there's nothing to engage with in terms of expression. So I see potential with those to go in a different direction,
They
which is
seem,
very, very exciting.
like they seem in a way, this may seem crazy, but it's almost like they are then the bones of the sculpture, right? They,
Yes.
in fact, when I look at it, and I've done a little bit of work looking at some macro images, I'm interested in really tiny things, of bone structure. There's an element of that there.
Yes, I can ex see exactly why you say that, because I was looking at that image of the black one recently and thought, oh, it's very like spinal kind of feeling to it. Yeah, and just a boniness. Which I'm really enjoying that, but I've got to be very careful that I don't become too sort of alien sci-fi. Don't you feel it's a little edge? Sometimes I look at it and I forget the name of that artist who is he Dutch or I can't remember. He does this amazing really dark, organic, slightly sci-fi drawings. And I think a lot of the Alien films actually, Geiger, I think it's Geiger. So I've just become aware, I think, oh, that's just a little bit too sci-fi. And it might be because it's sort of black and bony looking. So there's something to work on.
Tell us a little bit about your use of color. This podcast, of course, is called Color in Ceramics, and really it was in part designed to talk about surface design. And how, so So we've been talking about form, but you do have color on your form. So you don't just have raw clay, although you do that intentionally, I think, in some ways. So tell us a little bit about your use of color and how you think about that in the context of form and so on.
Well, I'm really lucky that I had such good training at my first 4 years of studying ceramics. And we were forced to do glaze theory and do a lot of testing and analysis and all that. So I came out of art school with a really good grounding in understanding glazes and slips in all its spectrum. But at that time, I was devoted particularly to raku firing, glazing and smoke firing and terra sigillata. I just felt it was really right for the kind of animal pieces I was making. You know, I liked that dark and tiki kind of look, the kind of ancient quality that it lent itself to. And so for most of the last 30 years, I have raku fired. That's been my primary source of colouring and finishing. More terra sigillatas, different kinds of terra sigillata, and that charred smoking than glazes, and some coloured slips and things as well. But I just got very, very tired of it recently. And having been in the States for 20 years and not been able to get a lot of the materials that I was used to in the UK to make the stoneware glazes that I was wanting to try, I just kept putting it off. I'll just keep carrying on raku firing. And then when I moved back to the UK 6 or 7 years ago, and it was really when I started making the cats that I knew that I didn't want to raku fire anymore. I was really tired of raku firing. It didn't hold any interest for me anymore. And I wanted to use stoneware glazes again, and have just about given up raku firing in favour of those kinds of colourants and the finish and the lovely stony sort of forever quality that you have with stoneware. Raku is very, ooh, it feels very unfinished and light and biscuity, and it is all of those things. It's wonderful, but I like the more sculptural feeling of stoneware, and I like the colour possibilities of using, oxides over glaze and in glaze and layering and double dipping. And although I'm only able to oxidize, my electric kiln, I'm trying to find opportunities to do, reduction firing, salt firing, wood firing, because, I have experience in all of that. It's just I'm not being able to do it here at home myself. But I know all those effects could be really exciting on the kind of work that I'm trying to do. For instance, the piece we were just talking about, the stacking animals, I can't imagine doing that in raku. I mean, I could do it, but it wouldn't have the strength and that feeling of permanence that stoneware lends you. I'm so in love with stoneware, and I did a lot of it when I was a student, and obviously when I was at high school as well. So it's in me. It's sort of impregnated in me. It's just I've not been able to embrace it as much as I would like to until recently. And I can't imagine going back to being a raku artist. I will probably still dabble a little bit, but as a sign of giving it up, I actually gave away my raku kilns, all bar but my smallest one. So, and also health-wise and everything. Oh my God, I've just, I've never been good at wearing masks and goggles. So I have breathed in so much smoke over a very long period of time, and in my eyes, and I just don't want to do all that stinky, messy stuff anymore.
I do see a few of your pieces here, some of your little foldable folks that have got some color on them. There's some orange and blue, and how do you think about the color that you apply? What's your thought process?
Well, those little folding animals, they can take almost any color. But I wouldn't use, for instance, those blues, the turquoise. I probably wouldn't use those on the cats. That blue has got its place somewhere. Maybe for some monkeys or something, but I'm just trying to expand my palette of really quite traditional eggshell dolomite matte, magnesium matte sometimes called. That again, I'm not looking at really shiny glazes. I'm looking at sort of satin eggshell finishes because I think that sits better with the kind of pieces I'm making. So I'm trying to keep them fairly matte without them being dry. But I want colours that are still quite natural. And specifically with the cats, I want to be able to put those stripes on and get lovely rich depth in those sort of browns and greys and oranges if I can. The thing about working in stoneware is you have to do a hell of a lot of testing because, comes the day you've got that piece of sculpture in front of you, and if you get it wrong, you're probably going to end up with a waster. Whereas with raccoon, you can reoxidize. If those blacks are not quite in the right place, you can reoxidize. You can also put a little bit of paint on here and there and enrich and just tamper with raku in the way you can't with stoneware. If that glaze runs a little bit too much, or if you didn't get it quite thick enough, you can glaze again, but not so much if I'm doing stripes and patterns. So I've been less adventurous with it. Because I need to really make sure my glazes are. I just need to know how the glazes are behaving.
For sure.
And because I've got different kilns as well, and they fire differently. And I'm not a very good glaze tester, I am a bit sloppy. So I do take risks. I've, in fact, talking about the little folded animals, I have a whole bucket with about 50 rejects in it. So, they don't always work for me. Just what I call proper glazing, stoneware glazing. You just have to you can't mess around.
Yeah, you need to practice with you need to practice with it, don't you? Like it's really like you're drawing, right? You were drawing when you were learning drawing and perspective and so on. You practiced over and over with multiple subjects in different ways with different tools, right? And glazing is the same. You really, at least in my experience, I've made many bad pieces because I've glazed them too quickly, right? Without really truly understanding the what the glaze was going to do.
Referring back to your glaze tests, really, people don't realize, I think, how it's a real art, that kind of glazing. It's incredibly studied, and still full of variables and nuance and all. And that's what makes it so exciting, I think. But you really. You're absolutely right. You really cannot do enough testing, and And this is something we had to do in college, you know, lay out our glaze tests and look at them and talk about what was happening and why this was happening and, you know, really try to understand the nature of a glaze. It's pure chemistry. And then, of course, it can change completely if you test tiles are great because they're all flat, maybe. But then you've got a rounded form to put that on, maybe a very tall form, so it might be slightly hotter at the top, a bit cooler at the bottom. Oh, why do we do
I think
it?
in my case, I keep thinking God or somebody has keeps giving me the opportunity to learn patience. And so clay requires a ton of patience.
Yes.
Persistence and patience.
Absolutely. Yeah, if
Yes.
anyone says you're impatient, well, maybe, but not so much so. And
That's
also,
it.
I think we're incredibly optimistic people. We must
Yeah.
be fueled by optimism to take so much risk all the time.
That's right, yeah. Hey, on that note, you've been a teacher and you've been an avid learner yourself. Well, what advice might you give a potter, a sculptor, a young or old or new or experienced? What's some advice you might have for somebody?
Learn techniques, learn all the techniques, study the techniques, absolutely diligently know the language of the material. So even if you don't like it, do it. Slabbing, coiling, pinching, throwing, casting, mold making, doweling, and all the things you can do on the surface, you know, carving, sprigging, everything you can do. I think try and learn as much about the material as you can. And of course, that includes slips and glazes as well. It's such a huge field. But I think if you limit yourself, you're sort of cutting off half your alphabet, really. Sorry, it's my cat. His muscles. So I think it's rather like a musician. You know, learn your instrument, learn your keys, learn the craft. Ideas, I think, are only as successful as your means of interpretation. And I think the more you understand about the material, what it's got to say, the more power you're going to have in your tank, the more fuel you're going to have, I think. That's how I was taught. And I think because I have a really deep, broad understanding of my material, I don't feel like there are any doors closed to me. I may not be a really good thrower, but I can throw well enough that I can use those shapes to make sculpture. I do think to try and embrace and learn as much about the material as possible, so you're not limiting your choices.
In a way, certainly I've experienced this and I see it in others. As soon as you begin to understand the technical components, that allows you to be freer in terms of your interpretation of the piece that you're trying to make, whatever it may be.
Quite so. I quite agree with that. Yes. And that's it. This sort of links in why I'm an advocate of this. That's why I went back to learn how to draw, because I knew I had these sort of blind spots, and I was limited. And I felt really frustrated because I didn't know how to do it. So yeah, the more tools in your toolbox, yeah, the more empowered you're going to be. Yeah,
Yeah, for
for
sure.
sure.
It's almost like another door opens for you when you learn new techniques that sort of work on top of each other, right? So that you become highly skilled. It becomes almost unconscious in some ways in terms of what you're doing.
You put it perfectly. Absolutely. So yeah, you can work really intuitively, you know, like a great chef, knowing what to do with, you know, a few random materials. You just, I feel I know the language of play better than I know the English language. And I love that. I think I've only thought about that recently. In the past few years, I thought, gosh, I know this material. I know how it's going to behave. It doesn't always mean it's going to work. It doesn't mean my glazes are always going to work. But I know it sort of better than I know myself. And that's a really great gift to have. I take it for granted, but I tried to go back and do some printmaking some years ago with a friend who's an absolute brilliant printmaker. And I've done a little bit of printmaking in my time, but I was so frustrated because I wanted to know, I knew what I kind of wanted to do in terms of imagery, but I didn't know how to do it. And I felt absolutely handicapped. I thought, for me to know what Steve knows and to be able to just make decisions intuitively, it's a lifetime's work. Well, that's what I have in ceramic, but I'll never have it as a printmaker. And it was really deflating. So, yeah, I embrace and celebrate the fact that, you know, I've worked long and hard with this mud, and I know this beast. Yeah,
absolutely. That's very obvious, and you're very successful in what you're doing. And I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us today. This has been enlightening to talk with you, and I'm sure our audience will really enjoy listening to you talk about your notions of color and ceramics and form and the things that we talked about, but maybe in particular about the learning process and how to get to be a master at your craft like you are.
Oh, Bob, thank you very much. It's been an indulgence to have this conversation with you. Really lovely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Color and Ceramics Podcast with Bob Acton and his guests. Please help others find the podcast by subscribing to this podcast wherever you find your podcasts, such as iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube, or other podcatchers. And don't forget to give us a review. We'll see you next time.
Testing, check, check, check.